Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports Podcast. I'm Dave Zirin. Thrilled to have on the show today the author of two of my favorite sports books. He is the person who has given us I Fight for a Living, Boxing in the Battle for Black Manhood, 1880 to 1915, and the absolutely iconic book We Will Win the Day, The Civil Rights Movement, The Black Athlete, and The Quest for Equality. He has a new book out, which is getting all kinds of buzz. It's called The Great Black Hope, Doug Williams, Vince Evans, and the Making of the Black Quarterback. His name, Dr. Lewis Moore. Dr. Moore, how are you doing, sir?
I am great. Thank you for having me.
No, thrilled to have you on the show. Thrilled to talk about this topic. But, you know, we've got a lot of listeners on our program who aren't necessarily football fans. They listen because we're where sports and politics collide. So some people listen for the politics and some people know their sports, but I gotta always look out for the folks who might not be as familiar with these debates. So maybe you could just start out for somebody who asked the question, well, why does it matter how many black quarterbacks there are in the NFL? Why does it matter who gets to play black quarterback? Why does this issue even matter at all when we talk about sports and politics?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, especially for the show. And there's a lot of like kind of sports and politics in this book because the position is all about politics. And so for those of you guys who don't know, I would say the quarterback is the most important position of all the sports. Generally, the leader, you're the probably the best athlete, not, you know, 40 time, but you're also deemed as the smartest person. And for so long, I would in the book, I talk about post 1940s when formations changed and a quarterback became the most important person. The black athlete was thought not capable of playing that, right? They thought he wasn't smart enough, right? So same things that keep him out of the military, right? The Marines and everything else are flying planes for the longest time, keeps him out of this position. They thought he couldn't lead. They thought like white players wouldn't follow him. Now this might not make sense now that the league's probably about 70-75% black. But back in the day, it's 90% white, right? And then, you know, it slowly increases. So that they thought he wouldn't have courage to stay in the pocket because the quarterback, even today, we have conversations about the quarterback staying in the pocket. And they thought, well, these black athletes lack courage and they would just run out. And then there's like the little stuff, like his speech, his dialect, right? Are you going to be able to understand this Southern black person? Will the white offensive lineman from the Deep South follow? And then there's the politics. A lot of stuff coming up in the 60s and 70s with the rebellions. White teams were worried that, okay, if we get a black quarterback, now this is an awful excuse, but if we get a black quarterback, what are the black fans going to do when he doesn't play, right? Are they gonna rebel? Are they going to protest? And so all these things work to keep black men out of the most position in football. And so what I do is really try to tell this story through two of the guys, Doug Williams and Vince Evans. So tell the history and then tell their journey.
Fantastic. Can't wait to crack this open, man. I'm really excited. I got my copy in the mail. And I just think it's so rich when exploring the kind of issues that you just raised. So follow up to that, though. I mean, first of all, maybe you don't agree with this statement, but it certainly feels like 2024 in the NFL, and when I say the NFL, I mean franchise owners, I mean executives, seem to have moved on from this question when it was an utterly TNT idea to say draft a quarterback in the first round. You know, nowadays you have situations like Bryce Young and CJ Stroud getting drafted back to back, 1 and 2 in the draft, and you know, no one so much as blinks, or an iconic franchise like the Pittsburgh Steelers, where both the quarterback and the backup quarterback are both black quarterbacks, and it's not something that becomes an issue that needs to be discussed or a column doesn't get written about. And, you know, I've been doing this long enough that in my writing lifetime, it was a huge deal when, like, Donovan McNabb played against Michael Vick in the NFC Championship game, and you'd never had black quarterbacks square off against one another. So it certainly seems like there's been an evolution of change. So the first question is, do you agree with that, or am I looking at it too superficially? And if you do agree with that, and I actually frankly think you will agree that there's been change over the last two decades, was there a particular point that you feel like was the crossing of the Rubicon towards a different way that executives looked at black quarterbacks? Was there a particular quarterback? Was there a particular instance, or has this been more of a slow motion evolution? Big question.
Yes. No, it's a big question. But, and also real quick on the Steelers, they also have a black punter too and a black coach. So, you know, they're in like rarefied air right there. But I would say there's a change, right? In the sense that we don't talk about it as much. We talk about it and, you know, trying to sell this book, right? To, you know how it works in the publishing game, you know, trying to say this is still an important subject, right? So how do you sell a book where you look and there's, you know, 15 starters to make them think that this is important? So one, you're right, there is a change. And the change for me is, it's a slow change because the black quarterback, if you look at college football, 60s and 70s, they're there, right? They're starting in the South. So Florida by 1974 has a black quarterback. Tennessee, Condris Holloway, black quarterback. There are like 8 starting black quarterbacks in the Big Ten at that time. Now what happens is in the college game in the 60s and 70s, they're still running like using a quarterback to run. And those stereotypes about the black athlete are working in their favor. So with the civil rights movement, with integration and the innovation of offenses, there's opportunity for black quarterbacks to play. In the NFL, they're still running a pro style system and they're still handicapped by their you know, their racism, you know, and you know, those blinders that they have on. But nowadays what's happening is, I think because of the way contracts are set up, right? If you watch, if any of these young quarterbacks, it's that fourth year, that fifth year, I have to commit $250 million to this guy. So if I'm going to commit $250, I got to know if he can play. The other part of it is the NFL finally is taking in more of the college game. And so if you watch the NFL, it's a lot of spread. It's a lot of the same thing the colleges are doing. You know, they'll have to put them on the center a few times because they have to rush them and figure things out quickly. I think they're adapting that, right? And all these guys are training at a young age. They have quarterback coaches at a young age. And so they're ready. So if you look at someone like Caleb Williams, who played Sunday night, and the B-roll that they're showing, from a young age, he's going to these elite quarterback camps, right? So he's being molded, and other guys like him are being molded. The game has changed, and so they're there. You also, on defense, it's a lot faster. I'm not getting into this like current NBA debate about who's better and stuff like that. But look, guys are faster nowadays, right? They're speed guys then, but they're all fast now. And so you actually need a mobile quarterback. You can't just sit back there. And so that's working in their favor too. Whether it's one guy or not, I don't think it's just one guy. Like I said, I think it's just a gradual approach. But the success of guys like Vic, and unfortunately he didn't study the game, so kind of put people back, but even someone who I know you love, like Kaepernick, I think we talk about Kaepernick as this icon because of the protests, but if you think about it, here he is, this prototypical quarterback. He's got the size, he's got the arm, and he's coming from this new style, this kind of pistol style at Nevada. And Jim Harbaugh sees something in it, right? That this guy can make these throws and I could also run with this guy. And Lamar's molded in that way, right? Justin Herbert and has the same coach now and the same offensive GM. He's just not as our offensive coordinator. He's just not as fast, but he's going to be molded in that way. So Kaepernick, as great as he does make these changes for, political statements, his game, his style of game, the success that he's able to have, I think it translates for a lot of these coaches. I know
And
it's a long-winded answer, but yeah.
no, that was great. And I think with the evolution of the game, and again, you just hit me with agree or disagree on this. You mentioned Herbert, you're seeing more white quarterbacks trying to learn how to run effectively with the ball, or at the very least move around in the pocket. I sort of had an aha moment over the weekend seeing the nephew of two of the most earthbound quarterbacks over the last 50 years, Peyton and Eli Manning, seeing their nephew Arch. I don't know if you saw this, do that, what was it, like a 50 or 60 yard
Yeah,
run,
he took off. Yeah.
juking people. I mean, I just saw that and I said, okay, we might be in a new era, not just for the black quarterback, but for how we play and for what's expected of quarterbacks.
Right. What do they say? He's deceptively fast, right? This is what we say about the white quarterback that can move, right? And so even watching a game like last night, seeing Kirk Cousins struggle back there, when he can't move, or Aaron Rodgers, they can't move anymore. And so they're going to continue to struggle a little bit, because the game is just going to come right at them. Now they're good enough with their eyes and their head and their reflexes to get away from that. But if you're not like a 15, 20-year vet like those guys, you're going to struggle if you can't move.
Here's a theory that I've had for quite a few years, and just again, throwing it at you to agree or disagree about the black quarterback's place in today's NFL. I have felt like that the success, or no, let me say the acceptance of a black quarterback by, the majority white NFL fans has coincided with this rise of something that didn't exist when I was growing up, which is this idea of the star offensive coordinator. Usually someone in their 20s, usually someone who never played in the NFL or maybe even in college, somebody who almost has a technocratic mindset or visage or presentation, and they're seen as almost like people with a joystick controlling the quarterback. And there's all this talk about, do you have an offensive coach? Do you have a young hot offensive coordinator? Someone from the Sean McVay tree is very hip these days. Kyle Shanahan. Is that connected at all? I know these young offensive coordinators are also very connected, of course, to the opening up of the game, the passing game, the game's gotten more complicated, all these different things. But I've always felt like there was a connection to sort of assuage the white fan that the quarterback position has never been more controlled by an external force.
Oh, that's super interesting. I never thought about it that way. Because when you're naming these guys, I'm like, these guys don't have. So the young guys, the McVay tree guys, don't have black quarterbacks, right? So McVay still like with Stafford. Shanahan is like, let me go Purdy. Now he has Josh Dobbs on the bench. They did risk everything for Trey Lance, and that didn't work out. The Bengals guys on that tree. Green Bay now is going that way, right? Because they got Jordan Love, and then they signed Malik Willis. But I don't know if like the fans, it's hard to say what the fans see. I think the acceptance of the black quarterback for me has always been that he's an exciting option. And the changes, so he's an option to the white quarterback, right? And so for the longest time, he was the guy coming in replacing the white quarterback who's the statue. And then he's going to start to run around and make some plays. So even Philly fans are probably like familiar, Cunningham replacing Jaws, right? I think that was a huge shift for a lot of people to see. Here's this guy, 6'4", 4'4", 40, right? Replacing the Polish rifle, in Philadelphia, that probably hit him pretty hard. Vince Evans, when he's replacing guys in Chicago, he's a speed guy, and people like that. They like that element of the game. But also, when things go wrong, they'll always remind you. But kind of get back to your thing is that they do need more control. Right. And I think that fans do like when the harnesses are reined in, when you do kind of control that quarterback. The question always with the black quarterback, and I dive into this a little bit with Vince Evans in Chicago, is how do you control that speed? And so like you can't just let him like just kind of scramble, and this is scramble such a bad term, but I think it's appropriate because there's a difference between scrambling and then designed runs. And so how do you bottle that up to just the right moment? And I think now we're in the era where coaches are willing to think about that. Back in the, for the longest time, for most the majority of the years we've watched football, coaches weren't willing to think about that. How do I have a dual threat quarterback and make them a true dual threat? Now I think we're in that, right? With like kind of like read options and stuff like that. Even last night, Jalen Hurts, who I don't think he's a fast quarterback, and they should probably stop running him. You know what they're running with, and systems are built around that. And I think people are comfortable understanding that. Like I'm nowadays, we're building a system around this style of play. So if I'm going to draft Justin Fields, this is my system. And fans are accepting of that because they've seen that before at the college level, and that's had great success.
God, love to ask you more things about how this evolved in college and came to the pros, but we'll circle back to that. Big question for you. As you well know, there have been books and documentaries that speak about the black quarterback. And you've been on news specials that speak about the black quarterback. What makes your book qualitatively different from what we may have read before about this history?
Yeah, no, that's a great question because look, I'm on a documentary about the black quarterback. We filmed it in 2021. It's from Vice Sports. I sat for another one in 2023. One comes out from Amazon Prime the same day my book comes out. When I started to write this book, after that, two books on the black quarterback came out, right? One in 22, one in 2023. And I have to sell, to publishers why mine's different. And I'll tell you a few things why it's different. One, if you know me and if your listeners don't know me, but I'm a researcher. That's what I do. And so nobody's gonna out research me. So if you read, I Fight for a Living or We Will Win the Day, you'll see that. And this one is the same. It's getting everything I can on quarterbacking off eBay. So we're talking like Pro Football Magazine, NFL Digest, reading random books called The Pro Style or Pro Quarterback, buying Bart Starr's book, buying books about and reading books about the T formation and Notre Dame. And then on top of that, it's sitting with newspapers. And so I explained earlier today on Twitter that, look, to talk about Vince Evans at USC in 1976, I didn't just get the LA Times. I sat my rear end down in front of the microfilm and got every single sports section from the LA Herald Examiner from August when football starts to the end of December, like every single sports section to sit there, PDF it, and then read all the articles on USC football, the Rams football. I did that for Doug Williams' senior year in high school, for Vince Evans' senior year in high school. I have every defender, Chicago Defender sports page from 1977 to 1983 just to read about Vince Evans. So I could have typed this in and done a search engine. But I want to sit with things and understand. So the research is there. The other thing is different is that most of the stuff on the black quarterback is like the books are, and I'm not knocking them, but they're kind of book in books, right? There is like, here's point A, here's point Z, and I'm just going to kind of fill you in and kind of give you a little bit of details, but not enough to give you a lot. And because of that, I didn't have to do that, right? So I didn't, I wound up cutting, I tell people, probably like 50,000 words. And a lot of it is to fit what I call a narrative. This is a tight narrative about two guys. And in that explanation about two guys, it's all the history, right? And so I'm talking the change in formations early on. So, the importance of Kenny Washington, who's actually the first black player to reintegrate football, coming in as a quarterback, right? And what that means, because he's a single wing quarterback at UCLA and he's one of the best ever. But now, by the time he gets to the game, it's a T formation. Explaining that. But also, look, I'm giving you the history of two guys who grew up in the South, born in 1955. Doug is born in rural Louisiana, like in a black community. It's not even a city. It's just there. And so the history of Reconstruction shapes his life. 100 years later, like here's a guy who has no running water until he's 14, no paved roads. Right, versus Vince Evans, who grows up in the heart of the civil rights movement in Greensboro, where it's very middle class family, where They have a thriving black education system, yet they're still pushing for integration. And
Yeah.
as I tell people, Vince Evans, if you've ever seen Remember the Titans, that's his life, right? But he's the black player on the bus getting bussed into the white school, and he just happens to be the quarterback. And then it's the story of these two guys that go two different ways. Doug stays in the South, plays with a legendary coach, Eddie Robinson. Vince goes to USC, plays with a legendary coach, John McKay, who's known as like colorblind McKay. Half his team is black in the early 70s. He has black quarterbacks, Jimmy Johns, who when they beat Alabama, he's got a black quarterback in Alabama. And then he's got like Vince Evans, and then he'll go on to coach Doug Williams in the pros. And then so it's their story, it's the story of the quarterback. And I don't think you get that in the other in the other books or even in the other documentaries, right? And it's no knock on these guys. I'm in these documentaries. But it's the stories they tell like 50 years later, it starts to sound the same, right? Because they get asked the same questions. And so I wanted to really dive deep into that. Like, okay, here's the they're gonna tell you what they think you want to hear. Now I'm gonna tell you what they really said in real time and what's really going on and really try to build this story.
Yeah, I think Professor Moore, one of the things you always do in your books that always opens my mind up is your way that you use and synthesize the black press. You just mentioned the Chicago Defender. As you were going through the history of the black press and its intersection with these quarterbacks, how self-conscious was the black press about the symbolic and political importance of seeing black athletes play this position?
It's huge, and I try to set this up in the introduction and some beginning chapters. But this, to me, is part of the civil rights movement because it's the most visible position in sports. By this time, the black press and really, let's be clear, all of America has kind of accepted that the black athlete is part of the civil rights movement, right? It's not obviously you're not King, you're not John Lewis, or Rosa Parks, but you're part of it, and the hope of the civil rights movement is that once you get integration, merit's gonna matter, right? Like race's not gonna matter. It's can you do the do? And the black quarterback is the visual representation of that. And for so long, if you turned on your TV or you watched read the newspaper in the 50s and 60s, you would see great black quarterbacks, but they didn't wouldn't get that opportunity. And so what happens is black Americans see that and say, you know what, this is happening to me too, right? At my job, at school, trying to go through medical school. And what they call it is the black quarterback syndrome, right? So it has two meanings. What happens to the black quarterback in pro football, right? You're black and you can't play this position no matter how good you are. But also what happens to black advancement outside of society. And so because of that, they black fans really root for the black quarterback. And they're very clear in some of these black press, these writers, like this is part of the movement, right? This means something to me. And the longer they see guys like Briscoe not get a chance, Joe Gillum, who played for the Steelers from 74 to 76, and actually beat out Terry Bradshaw in 1974 before he lost his job, James Harris, the struggles with Doug and Vince, they feel that. And so when Doug, spoiler to your listeners, when Doug Williams and Washington football team win the Super Bowl in that 88 Super Bowl, it's a big deal. It's one of the biggest deals, right? For anybody, right? It just happens to be the day before Black History Month, right? He wins the NFC Championship the day before MLK Day, right? So everything kind of lines up for Black history, but people feel that because they know what it feels like to be passed over. And so they're rooting for the black quarterback because they're really rooting for themselves. It's the same thing we'd see with Jackie Robinson in 1947.
Now, the other big question that I was—you mentioned Joe Gillum. There's Willie Thrower. I mean, there are a lot of really remarkable stories of the early black quarterbacks. Doug Williams is somebody who, of course, makes all the sense in the world for you to hang your hat on, given his historic role as the winner of that Super Bowl, and of course his early round draft pick with the Tampa Bay Bucks. There's just a lot of reasons. Coming from an HBCU, what attracted you to Vince Evans' story? What made him somebody you wanted to hang the hat on, of all people?
This is like my favorite question, because that's what everybody asks me, like, why Vince Evans? Like, so it could have been a Doug Williams book. But let me tell you why Vince Evans. One, if you know my work, it's never always about the main guy, right? So I Fight for a Living, which is a book about black fighters from 1880, 1950. It could have easily been a Jack Johnson book or whatever else. But everybody, to me, to make the point that I'm making even more important, like seem important, is that you got to include the guy people don't know, right? It's not just Jackie Robinson, not just Jack Johnson. So we will win today. It could be a Jackie Robinson book, but it's just the little stuff. It's Little League baseball in South Carolina. It's boxing in Louisiana. It's all these kind of little stories. And to me, Vince represents that. Now, it also helps that he's born the same year as Doug, and they have this similar, path to the NFL. But what also helps is that they're different quarterbacks. Doug, although he's a 4'8", 4'7" guy, fast for those days, and probably the second fastest quarterback at that time in the league, he's not Vince. Vince is Lamar Jackson before Lamar Jackson. He's a 4'5", 4'4" guy. He's 6'2". He's 220. He's pretty big, right? Lamar's skinny. He's Jalen Hurts, right? So he's the guy who says, no, you're a running back. What all these guys get, same thing Lamar heard, and he's the one of the guys said no. So he puts it in his contract when he gets drafted in 1977 that the Bears cannot switch him to another position without his permission. That's huge. Everybody before him got that choice. You try another position, or you're gone, or you go to Canada. And he had enough power to say, nope, you're not doing this to me. You're giving me a legitimate shot at quarterback, right? Even though you might see me as a runner. And that's powerful. He's also the first, beside, I mean, Briscoe, I don't really count. Briscoe's a quarterback, but three or four quarterbacks got hurt before he even got that shot. But he's the first running dual threat quarterback to get a legit shot where the coach says, you know what? You're better than the two other guys I have on the team. Right. And we're going to build this around you. And so to me, that's important because it's with him for the first time where a coach tries to figure out, will this dual threat idea work? Can I get a guy who has he's the most powerful arm, by the way. He's the best arm. Like he could throw it further than anybody. And he's the fastest in the league. How can we make this work to our advantage? Now, unfortunately, it doesn't work. And that's also important too. Right, because the other thing about Vince is he eventually leaves, goes to USFL, becomes one of the highest paid players in the game that time, but then he sticks around for so long. And so the epilogue is kind of like him, those times at the Raiders where he signs in 87 during the strike and he stays on until like 94, 95, gets cut every year and they bring him back. It's like he's the first full-time black backup. Before him, if you're a black quarterback and you're not a starter, you're gone. Doug's out the league less than 2 years after winning the Super Bowl because they don't see him as starter quality and they're not going to keep the black guy on the bench. So he is not only Jalen Hurts and Lamar before Jalen Hurts and Lamar, he is Josh Johnson, the guys we don't talk about. He is Tyron Huntley, who just got signed from the Ravens to the Miami Dolphins to now because Tua's out, right? He's Charlie Batch. He's these other guys who just get to stick around, like, man, this guy's still in the league. Tyrod Taylor, right? Who's been a backup his whole career, minus like a couple starts at Buffalo, and they try to get rid of him. So I think that's important to set that up. That before these other guys, there's this guy you've never really heard about. But he's really good, he's really popular. And the other thing, and I know I'm kind of rambling, what makes it easy for me to do, Vince, is he plays at USC. So everybody knows who he is in the 1970s. And then he plays in Chicago, right? So the prime of his career are major hubs. And so there's a lot of information about him. So it makes it works for me.
Wow, great answer to that. I'm excited to read the book. I'm excited to delve further into the life of somebody who I know very little about. You've been really generous with your time, but I do need to ask you the tropes of the black quarterback. It's tempting to ask if you think they're dead. It's tempting to ask if you think they're just resting, but could come back to life at any moment, like some horror movie character. But I can't really ask that question because, I'm in Ravens country. And I feel like a lot of the tropes we're talking about, you don't see him thrown on someone like Dak Prescott, for example. I don't even see him thrown on Jalen Hurts the way they're thrown on Lamar Jackson, doubting him on every conceivable level and on levels that feel much more 1970s and 1980s than 2020. Do you see an anachronistic criticism, of course, racist anachronistic criticism of Lamar Jackson? Am I being too sensitive? And of course, I'm talking about the media and fans, because the guy wouldn't have two almost unanimous MVPs if players in the league felt like he wasn't up to snuff, if executives didn't feel like he wasn't up to snuff. But it feels like in the culture of the NFL, there's this anachronistic response to him that feels pretty unique to him. Am I right about that? Wrong about that? What does the Lamar experience tell you?
I think you're right. And I think it's crazy, right? Because like you said, he's two MVPs. They made it to the AFC Championship and he can't catch a break, right? Like the criticism is the old racist criticism was so strong in the past, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, early 2000s, that you can't just say it's done, it's gone, and I'm not seeing Lamar through this prism. Anytime you talk about decision-making, I think that's part of it. Now, everybody, right, decision-making can be a very neutral thing, race-neutral thing. But a lot of times when we talk about the Black quarterback, it's not race-neutral, right? So I think those type of things, this idea that Kenny, you're really moving the goalposts back on him, so to speak, when we talk about him, when we criticize him. I think Hurts got a lot of that, too, in his rookie year. Did well what that one year they went to the Super Bowl, but I think it's getting back to him. And part of Hurts is just a different read about his attitude and his style and stuff like that. And then the other quarterback, I think we saw a lot of this last year, was Justin Fields. Can he read? So, I mean, we're opening questioning, can this pro quarterback read a defense? Can he make quick decisions? And I think that's part of this history that we see these guys. Now, Fields wound up being replaced by a Black quarterback and with a Black GM doing that, right? So it's hard for people to say, well, how does that make sense? But just go back and watch and listen when he gets replaced by that rookie last year, like Tyler Badgett, undrafted Division II, I think, guy, and how many people were like, wow, this guy's good. And then you watch the tape and you're like, wow, this guy is not better than Justin Fields. What's going on here, right? And I think that's part of it too. But like, you're certainly right, Lamar gets attacked a lot because he's so electrifying, because there's that speed element, and it's like he can't catch a break. And I know we're getting rambling here, but that AFC Championship game, he gets criticized for not running fast enough, right? Like, and I'm like, wait a minute, like you criticized him for running too much and now he's not running fast enough, right? He's trying to throw, like trying to prove a point. And so it's like, always like, give this guy a break, appreciate what you see here. Ooh. And the beauty about quarterbacking and football is that there's so many styles to play it. And I think as a nation, that's why we really appreciate it. So we have to understand, like, there are all types of the quarterbacks and we should appreciate them. But the other part is that I think that's a little bit different from now than back then, is that everything's online, everything's 24 hours, like it's boom, boom. And then everybody's negative, right? They feel like they got to be negative first to get someone's attention, instead of just say, I love watching this guy. And plus, I can't say anything bad about Lamar. He's my starting quarterback on my fantasy team. So, I'm a root hard for him. But I think people are so quick to be negative first instead of like positive first. And it's always going to come off bad.
Amen. I just feel like some of like the tone of the critiques towards Lamar are some, and I know a lot of that is just, sometimes it's just AFC North competitor fan teams, just trying to say whatever they can to get under Ravens fan skin. But when you have that cross swords or combine or become intertwined with the way racism, particularly on social media, has become more acceptable in the discourse, you get a lot of ugliness aimed at Lamar that feels like it's 1985. Or if there was social media in 1985, heaven forbid, you know, you'd be seeing very similar arguments. I'd be remiss before you go if I always ask people this who write books. I always ask them about music, and I always appreciate your taste in music. So I'm excited to ask you this. What is it you've been listening to as you've been putting this book together?
Oh, man. So real talk. So whenever I'm feeling good and I've like made the next milestone, you know, step, I'll put on some Biggie Juicy. You know, because that's one of those songs you put on to celebrate. And whenever I feel like, yeah, I proved myself, there's a lot of doubters, just to, you know, get myself pumped up, right? Because, you know, I'm at a small, I don't think people realize this. I mean, it's a decent size school, but we're like R2, or some people say just a regional teaching school, a state school, where scholarships not really expected. We don't have a lot of funds. I don't got a lot of time off. And so these things are hard to do, right? And so I always approach it from that kind of bottom up perspective. I'm gonna beat you, I'm gonna win. And so I like songs like that celebrate. So working out though, since I just worked out before I got on here, I'm old school. So I put on the Chronic. And then I switched to some E40 and Be Legit, and listeners, you know, it's a lot of bad words. But the beauty about E40 when you're working out to them, it's high, like it's really fast. It's very fast. And then Be Legit comes in, it's very smooth, very, very mellow. And so you get that good balance for your workout, right? It like picks you up and then you can kind of mellow out. So
love it. His name is Dr. Lewis Moore. The book, which I am so excited to crack open. I can't even to tell you how excited I am. The Great Black Hope. I'm hoping all of our listeners pick this book up. Maybe we could do a little reading group about it, because I mean, when Lou Moore writes a book, there are things that require not just reading, but discussion. Dr. Moore, thank you so much for producing this book. Thank you so much for joining us here on Edge of Sports.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much to the producers of this podcast. Thank you, David Tigaboo. Thank you to The Nation Magazine for sponsoring it. For everybody out there listening, please stay frosty. We are out of here. Peace.